Chapter 25. The Rise and Spread of Buddhism. First, the story of Gautama. Second, teaching and legend in conflict. Third, the gospel of Gautama Buddha. Fourth, Buddhism and Asoka. Fifth, two great Chinese teachers. Sixth, the corruptions of Buddhism. Seventh, the present range of Buddhism. First, it's interesting to turn from the mental and moral activities of Athens and Alexandria and the growth of human ideas in the Mediterranean world to the almost entirely separate intellectual life of India. Here was a civilization which, from the first, seems to have grown up upon its own roots and with a character of its own. It was cut off from the civilizations to the west and to the east by vast mountain barriers and desert regions. The Aryan tribes who had come down into the peninsula soon lost touch with their kindred to the west and north, and developed upon lines of their own. This was more particularly the case with those who had passed on into the Ganges country and beyond. They found a civilization already scattered over India, the Dravidian civilization. This had arisen independently, just as the Sumerian, Cretan, and Egyptian civilizations seemed to have arisen, out of that widespread development of the Neolithic culture, the Heliolithic culture, whose characteristics we've already described. They revived and changed this Dravidian civilization much as the Greeks did the Aegean, or the Semites, the Sumerian. These Indian Aryans were living under different conditions from those that prevailed to the northwest. They were living in a warmer climate in which a diet of beef and fermented liquor were destructive. They were forced, therefore, to a generally vegetarian dietary, and the prolific soil, almost unasked, gave them all the food they needed. There was no further reason for them to wander. The crops and seasons were trustworthy. They wanted little clothing or housing. They wanted so little that trade was undeveloped. There was still land for everyone who desired to cultivate a patch, and a little patch sufficed. Their political life was simple and comparatively secure. No great conquering powers had arisen as yet in India, and her natural barriers sufficed to stop the early imperialisms to the west of her and to the east. Thousands of comparatively pacific little village republics and chieftainships were spread over the land. There was no sea life, there were no pirate raiders, no strange traders. One might write a history of India coming down to 400 years ago and hardly mention the sea. The history of India for many centuries had been happier, less fierce, and more dreamlike than any other history. The noblemen, the rajas, hunted. Life was largely made up of love stories. Here and there a maharaja arose amidst the rajas and built a city, caught and tamed many elephants, slew many tigers, and left a tradition of his splendor and his wonderful processions. It was somewhere between 500 and 600 BC when Croesus was flourishing in Lydia, and Cyrus was preparing to snatch Babylon from Nabonidus, that the founder of Buddhism was born in India. He was born in a small republican tribal community in the north of Bengal under the Himalayas, in what's now overgrown jungle country on the borders of Nepal. The little state was ruled by a family, the Sakya clan, of which this man, Siddhartha Gautama, was a member. Siddhartha was his personal name, like Gaius or John. Gautama or Gautama, his family name, like Caesar or Smith. Sakya, his clan name, like Julius. The institution of caste wasn't yet fully established in India, and the Brahmins, though they were privileged and influential, hadn't yet struggled to the head of the system. But there were already strongly marked class distinctions and a practically impermeable partition between the noble Aryans and the darker common people. Gautama belonged to the former race. His teaching, we may note, was called the Aryan Path, the Aryan Truth. It's only within the last half century that the increasing study of the Pali language, in which most of the original sources were written, has given the world a real knowledge of the life and actual thought of Gautama. Previously, his story was overlaid by monstrous accumulations of legend, and his teaching violently misconceived, but now we have a very human and understandable account of him. He was a good-looking, capable young man of fortune, and until he was 29 he lived the ordinary aristocratic life of his time. It wasn't a very satisfying life intellectually. There was no literature except the oral tradition of the Vedas, and that was chiefly monopolized by the Brahmins. There was even less knowledge. The world was bound by the snowy Himalayas to the north and spread indefinitely to the south. The city of Benares, which had a king, was about 100 miles away. The chief amusements were hunting and love-making. All the good that life seemed to offer, Gautama enjoyed. He was married at 19 to a beautiful cousin. For some years they remained childless. He hunted and played and went about in his sunny world of gardens and groves and irrigated rice fields. And it was amidst this life that a great discontent fell upon him. It was the unhappiness of a fine brain that seeks employment. He lived amidst plenty and beauty. He passed from gratification to gratification, and his soul wasn't satisfied. It was as if he heard the destinies of the race calling to him. He felt that the existence he was leading wasn't the reality of life, but a holiday that had gone on too long. While he was in this mood, he saw four things that served to point his thoughts. He was driving on some excursion of pleasure when he came upon a man dreadfully broken down by age. The poor, bent, enfeebled creature struck his imagination. "Such is the way of life," said Channa, his charioteer, "and to that we must all come." While this was yet in his mind, he chanced upon a man suffering horribly from some loathsome disease. "Such is the way of life," said Channa. The third vision was of an unburied body, swollen, eyeless, mauled by passing birds and beasts, and altogether terrible. "That is the way of life," said Channa. The sense of disease and mortality, the insecurity and the unsatisfactoriness of all happiness descended upon the mind of Gautama, and then he and Channa saw one of those wandering ascetics who already existed in great numbers in India. These men lived under severe rules, spending much time in meditation and in religious discussion. For many men before Gautama, in that land of uneventful sunshine, had found life distressing and mysterious. These ascetics were all supposed to be seeking some deeper reality in life, and a passionate desire to do likewise took possession of Gautama. He was meditating upon this project, says the story, when the news was brought to him that his wife had been delivered of his firstborn son. "This is another tie to break," said Gautama. He returned to the village amidst the rejoicings of his fellow clansmen. There was a great feast, and a nauch dance to celebrate the birth of this new tie, and in the night Gautama awoke in a great agony of spirit, like a man who's told that his house is on fire. In the anteroom the dancing girls were lying in strips of darkness and moonlight. He called Channa and told him to prepare his horse. Then he went softly to the threshold of his wife's chamber and saw her by the light of a little oil lamp sleeping sweetly, surrounded by flowers, with his infant son in her arm. He felt a great craving to take up the child in one first and last embrace before he departed, but the fear of waking his wife prevented him, and at last he turned away and went out into the bright Indian moonshine to Channa, waiting with the horses, and mounted and stole away. As he rode through the night with Channa, it seemed to him that Mara, the tempter of mankind, filled the sky and disputed with him. "Return," said Mara, "and be a king, and I will make you the greatest of kings. Go on, and you will fail. Never will I cease to dog your footsteps. Lust or malice or anger will betray you at last in some unwary moment. Sooner or later, you will be mine." Very far they rode that night, and in the morning he stopped outside the lands of his clan and dismounted beside a sandy river. There he cut off his flowing locks with his sword, removed all his ornaments, and sent them and his horse and sword back to his house by Channa.